Hello and welcome to Conscious Pathways, the podcast where we explore the intersection of education and social justice through transformative conversations. I am your host, Brittany, and as always, I am so excited for you to be joining me on this journey. This week, I am joined by a fantastic guest, Azuma Jordan. Azuma has such a wealth of knowledge. She's been an educator for over 30 years. She has been in pretty much every realm within early education that you could possibly be, from in the classroom to out of the classroom admin positions. Azuma is a consultant, an educator, and really what stood out to me when I was looking through just the breadth of her work was her concept of police-free and ECE. That really stood out to me. As an early childhood educator, I've worked with many students across different backgrounds, and one thing generally remains the same is that kids are pretty curious about power dynamics. They're curious about who has power, who's good, who's bad. They're really curious about investigating this through their play. So you'll often see young children playing kind of as cops and robbers, or I'm the superhero, or I'm the cop, I'm going to put away the bad guys. And I always found myself a little, I suppose, uncomfortable with these dynamics, not necessarily with the children themselves. I know that they are trying out different facades and they're trying out different personalities and characteristics. So not necessarily within them, because I know it's developmentally appropriate for them to be curious about these topics. But I, as an educator, never really knew how to address these conversations in a way that honored their development and also in a way that proposed different concepts or different ideas. And I know my approach was always to just ask more questions. I think that's my general approach to most things in life, is to ask more questions and to get a little bit more clear and help other people to consider different perspectives. And so I think it's a really fascinating idea to take this concept that kids are already grappling with, that they're already asking questions about, they're already acting this out in their play about power dynamics and who has power and what that looks like. And there are ways that we can address that in the early learning community. But for the longest time, I felt a little lost when it came to this, because I didn't know how to address it in a way that was sensitive and collective, because not everyone has positive associations with the police. And especially sometimes you'll have community visitors. And it wasn't really until I started learning about restorative justice and social justice and different ways of just approaching that I started to become a little bit more clear in my practice with it. I wish I had someone like Azuma to walk me through how I can handle these conversations and still be understanding of everyone's experiences and everyone's lived experience and everyone's reality. Azuma, throughout this conversation, really drives home the idea that it is, as educators and people who work with young children and people who work with children or students in general, it is our ethical responsibility to do no harm. Similar to how the Hippocratic Oath is the guiding force for medical professionals to do no harm and to support all people, that is our guiding force in education as well. We want to reduce harm, we want to do no harm, we want to increase equity, we want to increase access. And so that's something that I have been thinking about every day since this conversation. And I cannot wait to share this conversation with you. So let's hop into it. Hello and welcome to Conscious Pathways. I am joined by Azuma Jordan. Thank you so much for joining me today.
You're welcome. Hello, good morning, good evening, good afternoon.
Exactly. I never know where people are. Yeah, I don't know where people are listening. Like, am I your morning podcast? Am I your afternoon podcast? Am I your late night podcast? People do that. I don't know.
For somebody, sometimes it is.
Exactly. I'm so excited to have you joining me. Actually, one of my close friends had suggested I reach out, and I was looking through all your stuff, and I was like, ooh, this is amazing. I need to get her on the podcast. So thank you, Julia, for the suggestion. Before we get into all the beautiful and amazing things that you do and bring to the world, tell me a little bit about your journey into education.
I've been in early education for over, I think, 35 years now. I had my first introduction being an assistant in school-age programs. I was a camp counselor in high school. And like, I would babysit. That's how I made my extra money, babysitting, taking care of my siblings and other people's children. and then, you should become a teacher. So in high school, I shadowed elementary school teachers. This isn't me. Like, it was the 80s, early 90s. And teachers back in the day, it was a lot more cute sweaters and just like a vibe that, like, I don't know, like a lot of canned curriculum. I love working with children. I love teaching, but I don't know if this is for me. And then I got a job after a year of working at a camp counselor. I was recommended to be an assistant at a preschool. So I was the opener infant toddler teacher. So I welcomed the babies in school in the morning, and I worked in the office as admin. And that was the start. And so I worked almost every job you can in ECE. So I've been an assistant teacher. I've been a lead teacher, a mentor teacher. In ECE, we team teach. So there's always multiple teachers. And I actually like that. I like the collaboration of that. I've worked preschool, and I've worked pre-K, and I've worked mixed age group. So I've done all the ages.
You've really done it all.
So now I'm a consultant. I use all that experience into working with other educators, with particular focus on leadership. I'm mainly a content expert in racial justice, social justice, and play-based. But, you know, I always have my love for play-based curriculum and progressive education in general.
You've been in every area that one could be within early childhood. You really have a good purview of what everyone's going through and what everyone's experiencing in that, which is really incredible. Especially that focus on anti-racism and abolition and this critical thought within early childhood. I think it's a conversation that's generally missing in education in general, but specifically for early childhood, it's something that is very neglected in part of our field. That thought that kids don't need to be exposed to these types of topics, or they don't need that. They're just little kids. They don't really want to have these conversations. And we know that it starts early. Like, these conversations, the questions they're asking, the representation, all of these things start so early in their development, right? This is where they're learning about how the world works. They're learning about how they fit into the world, how they perceive others and how others perceive them, right? Mm-hmm. So there's so much that's going on in their little minds. And so I love seeing more people out there in the consulting field, which is also what I do. But it's beautiful to see that there's more people out there who are centering this conversation, especially when we're talking about decolonization and all those different things. It's very important. And you mentioned play-based. How do those two topics go hand in hand? When we talk about anti-racist work and we're talking about community, how does that go hand in hand with play-based learning?
In my mind, where the connection is that play is a right of children, right? It's the right of childhood. And so as the adults in their lives, it's our responsibility to make sure that that happens, that it's essential to their development. So since it's a right, that goes into and is integrated in thinking about who has access to that, and your race and your gender and your socioeconomic status impacts if you're able to play and what you get to play with, what's available to you. When people think about play-based curriculum for children, they think about preschools that that say that they're play-based, they think of them as white schools.
Yeah, you hear that a lot. So that's for the white kids. Gentle parenting, that's for the white parents.
Yeah.
Those play-based schools, like, that's for the white kids. I was talking in a previous episode with Dr. Dutant, and we were talking about DEI work and how important this is and how important it is to, one, take care of our DEI practitioners, but also that this work is for everyone. Mm-hmm. And we talked about especially how as Black people, Black and brown people, or BIPOC people, in order for us to show up in the world, we have to be this phenomenal being. We have to exceed and we have to go above and beyond. Mm-hmm. And that you know, feeds into higher education, but it also is prevalent in early childhood education. Like, you need to be the best and the brightest, and you need to be the top of your class, and you do all these types of things. And so, you know, when we're thinking about spaces for children, you know, obviously with early childhood, there's this voice and choice disparity, right? So if you have the money to pay for these really expensive schools, the ones that are play-based or Montessori or any of those other words, like if you have the money to pay for it, awesome. If you don't, your options are usually Head Start, state-run preschools, family, friend, and neighbors, right? And so those are the options that you just have available to you.
Right.
And when we're talking about play-based preschools, especially for the BIPOC community, that's not something that we're thinking about. You know, they need to be academically rigorous. They need to know how to read. They need to know how to spell. But us as practitioners, we know that their play is their learning. That's how they learn. That's how they explore. And that's how these things seep into their mind and their conscious and their psyche.
What's the standard, right? Because we want our children to be educated. It's very important. Being descended from people who were enslaved in America, knowing that ancestors were killed or punished, learning to read and having an education and knowing not even far off ancestors, just like a generation, the things that my mom went through, the things that my grandmother, my aunts, my cousins, they went through just to have an education makes it key and important. And so the education that I've invested in, my family has supported me to have, knowing that, again, play is a right, is essential to children's development. So why would I want less for Black children?
I'll let that sit and marinate for a second.
And so if that's the key for development, that then I want them to have it in a way that's culturally responsive, that's actually going to support their cognitive development. So they are ready for direct instruction with reading, writing, math concepts. And the thing that people are most focused on are the things that aren't actually developmentally appropriate yet, right? Children should be illiterate. And learning to read happens between 4. That's like the earliest, and that's a very smart amount. And then around 9 and 10. So that's a huge developmental span. And so to expect children that everybody should be reading in preschool and kindergarten and first grade isn't appropriate, isn't a standard that we should be holding children to. And the reason why that standard is because we can make money off of that fear. That fear of, oh, they'll be illiterate. They won't learn they won't learn to read and write. They'll be behind. But the standards are inappropriate.
Yes.
If we want children to be ready for that, like school readiness, I don't believe that children should be ready. The school should be ready for children. But that's the language that we use. So I'm going to use that language. And so if we want children to read, then we need to have one be an example. Are we readers? Are we reading with children? Are we showing them that this is fun and exciting? Do they see us reading for joy and for fun or just for lessons? Because if you want to be a reader, you have to do it for fun. It has to be an enjoyable experience, or your brain won't allow you to even learn that. Because it won't learn in stress. So we're reading to babies, having babies on our lap and reading to them and enjoying that and like doing silly voices and like they get to turn the page and gnaw on the board book, right? They're having an experience of warmth and fun. And if you grow up in that and you're held in that, then you're going to want to read. And you're going to want to do it yourself, right? Because 3 and 4-year-olds always like pretending to read. That's when they want to hear the same book over and over again. And then you'll see them in the book corner or on their mat, like telling a story, holding the book up, right?
Yeah.
That's what you want to see.
Yes.
And then when you say, we're going to have reading lessons, they're like, sign me up. I'm ready for this.
Yes. Yes. Because reading isn't something that our brains do naturally.
Yes.
Our brains are not developed for written word. We've always been developed for kind of spoken word mm-hmm. and visual things and things like that. So learning to read is really counterintuitive to what our brains do with information automatically. So you're having to retrain your brain to do a thing anyways.
Yes.
And then we're asking this of very young children
yes.
to do this very hard thing.
Yes.
And so when people talk to me about early literacy, and it's something, I'm based in California, so it's something that we've been talking about, especially with the expansion of PK to all four-year-olds, mm-hmm. and they're trying to now expand it to all three-year-olds, and that's a right. situation. And see about literacy, they're like, when early childhood, like, how are you preparing them for reading and early literacy? And it's like, my job in early childhood education, when it comes to that, is to build and foster that love of learning. Mm-hmm. Is to build that intrigue with reading. Are we doing this in a way where it's not stressful? It's comforting. They're involved in the process. They want to be involved in that process, right? If I follow a child from birth all the way up to 5 years old before they go off to kindergarten, I want them to have literacy experiences that are meaningful,
mm-hmm.
that are impactful, that are culturally relevant, that mm-hmm. are sustaining, that are responsive to what they feel, what their community is going through, what they see outside of that classroom.
Yeah.
I want to foster those types of experiences.
Mm-hmm.
I do not care at the end of, again, the child who's 5 years old going into kindergarten, I could care less if they know what sight words are. I'm not trying to teach them sight words. In fact, I don't even believe in sight words,
mm-hmm.
but I could care less about that. But are they interested in print concepts? We have the California Learning Preschool Foundations and Frameworks, and what I do like about that is when it does talk about early literacy and the stages that it goes through, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's just, are they interested in print concepts?
Yes.
When they're holding a book, are they holding it the right way by a certain age, right? It's not upside down. They're not trying to read it horizontally,
yeah.
right?
If you're watching children, you'll see that. What we're also looking for is they know the orientation. Like they know mm-hmm. that you start reading here, even if they can't read, if they already know that you start looking at the words right here, you go across. You start here, you mm-hmm. go across. Those are the actual skills that they need to read.
Yeah.
And that's what we're here for.
Yes.
And exactly. So everything that you said, like that's science.
Yes. If we shift gears a little bit. So part of your work also goes into, as we mentioned, that restorative justice aspect of it and rethinking community helpers and instituting that restorative justice practices.
Yep.
Can you talk a little bit about what inspired you to talk about this and what your work around this looks like?
So the story that I tell is that I was working at a center and I was a teacher and we had a police visit.
Yeah.
And one of the little girls was like, I don't want to go. And they were like really afraid. And so I was like trying to figure out what's going on because they weren't usually like that. Everybody likes to go. It's a special thing. Everybody wants to go do it. Long story short, she had seen someone that she loves be arrested. And it was very for her because like they took him away. They went to jail and the police were mean. They were like pushing and shoving and like threw them on the ground. And so like it made sense that like, no, why would I want, like, am I being arrested? Like, why would I want to go see the police officer? And my director was not happy with that. At this school, it's primarily Black and brown children and she was white. And I bring that up because what she said was that, like, these children need to know about, like, the police and know about authority.
The implication of that.
Yeah. So I didn't stay there that long after that.
I wonder why.
But that, like, is like, my origin story.
That was
like,
the arc.
You know, like, right now, people online ask, like, what radicalized you? That's what did it, right? That made me rethink this very prominent practice and this idea that police are community helpers. So that had just been quietly my practice, I would take the police out of the little lecture block. And then if somebody asked for me, then we had a little conversation about it.
Yeah.
Practice. And I just did that in my classroom. And then as a consultant, and when like the uprising happens, it became another opportunity to talk about that, right? Because people were like, how do I talk to children about police brutality? And so I was like, oh, like the way I've been talking about it is questioning police as community helpers. Because that's like, that's why people are like, oh no, because it was assumed virtue. Used to use an academic term, assumed virtue. That we assign them virtue. But especially if you're Black and brown, if you're queer, if you're not white, affluent, you don't have a good relationship with the police. And maybe not even you personally, probably not in your community that has encountered the police. You've encountered the justice system. You know about alternative economies because you can't get work. And so that kind of started up again, requests to start talking about that. That has become one of my focuses. And I do that work right now with a group of educators and people that work there as resource and referral people. And I have a group called Police Free and ECE. So
I was wondering, as you started telling the story, year, what time frame that original incident happened? Because as you mentioned, we've had a couple of reckonings throughout the last couple of years, last like 10 plus years. Obviously, it's an issue that's been ongoing that kind of predates this. It wasn't like police brutality just suddenly popped up in the 2010s, right? It's been going on for a while, probably since the very inception of the police in general. That's why they came into existence, right? During slavery and the origins of...
Like the history of policing in America.
Exactly. And so, you know, when people start questioning, you know, why are people so uncomfortable with it? Like police brutality, like people, you won't get brutalized if you're just listening. You won't do, you know, all these different things. It's like, that's not the case for everybody, right? You can be completely complacent and completely agreeable and still have police brutality done against you and your body. So it doesn't necessarily matter that. And then they look at the bodies and the people who are persistently subjected to this, right? If you're a Black or brown person, someone, either you've experienced police brutality or someone close to you that's experienced police brutality. And it's something that is very prevalent in our communities and it's difficult, right? And so when we're having conversations with children, I know I always felt really uncomfortable when I would see the little Lakeshore police people and it's always a little white police officer. And just thinking about what is this saying? What message am I sending to children? And when it goes into play, we know that especially young children and particularly young boys seem very interested in this concept of power dynamics. You'll see in their play more often. They'll either emulate police officers or superheroes, or they're really grappling with this idea of good versus bad, good versus evil, right? They're really grappling with this concept, and they're part of the way that they are processing that is through their play, right? Which kind of goes back to what we were initially talking about, is
like it's all play. It's connected, right?
It's all connected.
It's not separate. And what we should be paying attention to. They're not too young, because the reality is that in America, in our context, you're born into a white dominant society where white supremacy, the way dominant culture acts, that's what you're born into. Yes. So you're already experiencing that. You're trying to make sense of it.
Yes.
You start to pay attention. Some people have power and some people don't. And they're usually the people that are powerful.
Yeah.
These are seen to be the people that you're like. And so then they think, am I like that? If I'm not like that, then am I bad?
Yeah.
Well, maybe I'm not bad because I'm wonderful. So, but maybe the other people that look like me, maybe they're bad.
Yeah.
And they deserve it.
Yeah.
So there's lots of things that come out, the thought process that comes out, and it's a reflection of our society. It's a reflection of what's already happening in our communities and in their lives and in their families. Is this the message I want them to hold on to and think that this is correct? And if the answer is no, then, well, and the answer should be no with these things, then it's our job and our responsibility to disrupt that.
Yeah. And to ask those questions, not only of ourselves, but just to involve the students in that questioning.
Yeah.
It's not something that you always have to grapple with yourself on your own. Yes, it's a big part of that. That is your own internal reflection and your own inner biases that you need to, there is some internal work with these ideas, right? And it always starts with questions, asking them, what do you know about this? What questions do you have about this? What does it look like?
And maybe the relationship that I would have with children is that they know that, like, I'm observing because I'm writing little notes and I'm reading them notes, right? And I'm, like, taking pictures and I'm documenting. This caught my attention. And I'm wondering if that's, like, what you're thinking.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then they'll tell you. Because sometimes people don't know what to do if they're not directly teaching. It's what we're supposed to do. But we have to actually have discussions and engage and have quality questions. Like, one of the sayings is, like, don't ask children questions you already know the answers to. And so when we do that, and that's to reflect when we're like, what color is this?
Yeah.
What letter is this? That's not actually teaching. Because children are like, you don't know. And a lot of people, like, you just need that one kid to say that to you. Like, why are you asking me? You don't know? Your mommy didn't teach you that? So have real curiosity behind it. And that only happens if we're, like, really observing. If we're not focused just on ourselves trying to teach and, like, be the teacher.
Yeah. It's a transition from being, from what we traditionally have been taught to think that teaching is, which is standing in front of the classroom and you're bestowing upon them all of the knowledge that you have. You're like, yes, I'm the all-being, all-seeing, knowing teacher of omnipotence, right?
Yeah.
And transitioning from that vision of what teaching looks like to more of a facilitator role, where I'm hand in hand with you as we're learning this together. And I want to see what your questions are. I want to understand where you are in terms of where you're learning this and where you want to go. And I'm just facilitating that learning process with you. I am not, my job is not to bestow upon you with all of this knowledge. I want you to be curious. I want you to ask questions. I want you to think critically about information. Don't just trust me because I'm here, right? I want you to think critically about this information. And that's the society that I want to live in.
Thinking about, like, what your role is and what you actually want for children. Like, what's the messages? Like, why are you here? If you're here just because, like, you can boss people around. Then, like, this isn't the place. If you're curious and interested in supporting development and to love and care about the children in your community, this is the place for you.
It is. And this has me thinking again, connecting back to a point that you brought up earlier. I was thinking about this book by Dr. Casey Stockstill. She was talking about segregation in preschool and how it's still very prevalent. And Head Start is going to be for lower income families. Oftentimes, you're going to see a lot of black and brown children as the majority of the population of Head Start classrooms. And as we were saying before, there's that voice and choice. And so with the privately funded preschools, it's going to be families who have quite a bit of money. You can pay 20 grand plus a year for their child's preschool tuition. And that's, like, for one child. And so you're going to see just a difference in socioeconomic status. You're going to see differences in culture, ethnicity, race. You're going to see all these differences in these two settings. And what's interesting is when you look at the more kind of federally funded or state funded programs, the power dynamics are different. The questions that she was observing, even at kind of circle time, the language that they use, there's the private preschool group time at the Head Start, the one that she specifically was observing at, use it as work time. It was like the vocabulary that they used. Oh, we're going to go do our work time. And the power dynamics were just very different. There were certain things in the Head Start. They couldn't celebrate certain holidays. They couldn't use certain language. They couldn't. And it was just, there was so much rigidity in their day-to-day practices. And it just has me reflecting on this type of practice of when we only provide students from certain backgrounds. We only provide them with care that looks like power over. Mm-hmm. And that's the only kind of thing that they're seeing. What are we actually communicating to them about their power? What are we actually communicating to them about their ability, right? When they don't have very much like fluidity and structure into their day, and everything is decided for them. How does that help them to then question these types of practices, to have this type of mindset? Whereas we have the more private preschool, they don't have a government entity holding that over them at any time of the day. So there's a lot more flexibility in their schedule and their day. I've had, you know, the pleasure of working for pretty much almost every avenue in early childhood, similar to you as well. So I've worked in a family childcare. I've worked in state-funded Head Starts. I've worked for privately funded preschools. And in all of those, you know, I personally preferred working in the privately funded ones just because I had so much freedom in what I could do. I could create my curriculum. I could celebrate the holidays, all the different things. I just had the freedom and movement to be able to do that, where I didn't have that same flexibility in the state-funded schools that I had worked in. Mm-hmm. And speaking, melding this into this current conversation and what we've been talking about throughout this conversation, if there are schools out there or there are teachers or leaders who are listening to this and are curious about how do we start these conversations about power, privilege, and oppression with young children, specifically going into our police community helpers and questioning this, where do you think they can start with this?
Go through myself.
Go through the
meeting. I want to make a good impression. So one, don't get fired and then email me and I'll have a jockey find me a job. Thing that I advise is people to get in community. This isn't an individual work for you to do. This is that for us to do. Okay? And sometimes you might need coaching. And in that community, like getting support of, and like thinking about what strategically you're going to do. So you're like, hey, I do want to think about this. And it might not be great to just go into school on Monday and take all that stuff out, get those puzzles and X out. Maybe that's not the first step. Yeah. So maybe the first step is to do as Brittany's. Do some self-reflection and be clear about what's the message. And also do some investigation about what's the rule. And you also have to think about what's called fidelity to the curriculum, right? So there's always places where you can like, this isn't aligned with our values. So if we're taking abolitionist work, anti-oppression work, or ethical responsibility to do no harm, oppression harms everyone, and especially harms children because they have the least amount of power. Maybe you bring it to your work time. And I was listening to this lady and she was talking about that police aren't always community helpers. Because sometimes, and maybe you have a story when you were young, maybe you have a story, you know, whatever is appropriate to tell. And so I want to talk to you. What do you know about that? And start to investigate and tell those stories and figure out, like, yeah, like lots of people do think that like police are good people. And especially like, what if like your mom, your uncle, your favorite uncle and their police. And this isn't about just like the individual person. This is about something that's called systemic. It's systemic. That means that it's a system. And so at school, if you do something wrong, do you go to jail? Do I come and snatch you up and put you over here and say, sit there? And if I did do that, like, how would you feel? Would that be right? So, but what could we do? If someone makes a mistake, what should we do?
I feel so good in my soul. My soul felt that.
So that, those are the conversations that I've had with children. Those are the conversations where I support teachers in having. And find your own way in it.
It's so important.
And thinking about what's going to be the resistance, because there is going to be some resistance. But we're not punks around here, right?
Sure.
And we're going to stand up, right, and do the right thing. Because, again, it's our ethical responsibility to do no harm. And believing, and just like flatly believing that police are community helpers for some children, that's a life and death idea. And you don't know that you could be in danger. That's actually irresponsible. It's our ethical responsibility to do no harm. So that means we have to talk about stuff and not just say stuff because it's in the curriculum.
And I love that connection to community, because that is a key core part of it. If you just go in your classroom tomorrow and just decide, okay, I'm just gonna take all the figurines out and do all the things, like, I am now anti-racist and we got this, you're gonna have a hard time.
Either way. Make it harder for yourself, right?
Don't make it harder. Lean on your community. And like you said, with those values, have that values and know for your curriculum, for your organization, for your school, what do you value, right? What is in that handbook that you're giving out to parents, right? Is it in there that, hey, we're going to be questioning some hard things, right? So parents know, so that you're not having this whole uprising all of a sudden of, and like, why are you doing like social justice?
Parents know all the time. And nobody knows until it comes up. Because that's just being in relationship with people, right? You don't know that you didn't want that until somebody brought it. And that's okay. Yeah. So I think also we have to remember that conflict is part of being in a relationship and part of being in a community.
Yes.
Right? And so it's, again, that's why we have to know that here's what we're doing and here's the reason why. And feelings aren't facts. Like, even if they get upset, that's not the reason not to do it. Because their feelings do not override our ethical responsibility. And that's hard because, again, we're in a white dominant culture with a culture of niceness, especially early childhood educators, and trying to avoid conflict. There's no way we can do that. And so we also have to know how to resolve conflict with our community members. So it's not like they don't have a right to be upset and not like it.
Yeah.
We stop. Because when you say it's our ethical responsibility, this is what we do here. And again, this community is a choice.
Yeah.
So maybe you didn't read that far into it. Because who really reads it? All of us sign off on more paper, but did you read the fine?
That's true.
And even if it isn't in here, it's always implied because my ethics go with me wherever I go.
Yes.
And 9 times out of 10, like, they're just mad, and like, you talk about it and you give the reasons, and most of the time they stay. Even if they threaten, well, I'm gonna go talk to someone and we're gonna leave. Okay. Because you can't let people hold you with emotional blackmail, manipulate you like that.
That's what it is. That's what it feels like.
That's what it is.
And it's such a beautiful feeling when you stand in your values and you have your community, your school community is behind you.
Yes.
So when someone comes in and says, I don't like this, I don't want this, or whatever it is that they're saying, you could stand in your values again, saying, you have ethical responsibility. This is what our school stands for. This is what we do. You have experienced my admin not backing you up, and you just feel, okay, now I'm just on an island over here. But I've experienced it where you have your admin and your school community are behind you, and they're all saying, no, this is what we're doing.
Yep.
So take it or leave it, but this is what we're doing here. It's affirming. It feels great. And so, again, going back to have a community, lean on that community, and that conflict that comes up, work it out together. Just know that we're a community. We're in this together. Our ultimate goal here is the education of these young children.
Yeah.
And it's a beautiful experience. And on that subject, tell me a little bit about how you reimagine education.
Imagine it. Just as what we were talking about, like, these are the conversations that we have. These are like who we're in community with. that even if you are like in a place and your app doesn't support you in this economy, you can't just, again, quit your job. Because my mom really wants me to tell y'all that. She always reminds me, don't get people fired out of here. I'm like, okay, mom. My mom doesn't want you, and probably whoever loves you doesn't want you just to get fired. But it also means that in your community, helping you, like, oh, I need to be in a different place. And there are places out there.
Yeah. Protect your peace. Do what you got to do.
And I think, like, when I dream, like, I dream about being community, like, meeting more people, connecting to more people. Just, you know, a fair, equitable, and just world for everyone. That's playful and full of laughter. Because I think when you say you do social justice work or DEI, whatever the language is that we don't want to upset the right about, that for some reason, like, people think, like, it's, like, heavy and not fun. And I don't know that life. Like, I know the joy. Like, it is, it's hard and it's serious and a struggle, but I also know the joy. And I also know the deep love and care that you get. You might feel that you're alone, but, like, your people are out there. And if you're listening here, like, we can be your people. That's, like, in my reimagining, I try to live that every day.
I connect with that. Again, down into my core and my soul and my essence of being, I connect with that. Your people are out there, whether they're your colleagues at work, whether they are people outside of your work community, just in your regular community, whether that's people you find community online with. Mm-hmm. We're out here. We be doing stuff. Find us. You can join our community. We'll welcome you with open arms. As long as we're willing to learn and be a part of community and our responsibility to know and do better, come join us.
And what makes it great and what makes it fun is because we have shared value.
Yes.
And those shared values grow and heal.
Yeah.
And that's the foundation.
That's the foundation. You can't build a house on shaky foundation.
When I reimagine, that's what I want from me. That's what I built for myself. That's what I built for my family. That's what I built for my community. And, like, it's for everyone.
And speaking of community, where can my audience find you?
In my house, taking a nap.
Yeah.
I watch TikTok, but I'm not on it because I'm like, I just don't need another. I just don't need another social media thing. I have a website. You can reach me through that. If you want a particular community around abolition, you can join our Police Free ECE. It's $3 a month, so I can pay for the admin for that and and like the page on my website. And we have teachers and admin and parents to be a part of that, and we meet once a month, and we're starting to do actions and have workshops. So that's it. And I also have another anti-racist informal community. It's mainly leaders and college professors. It's a mutual support group that I also have. So if you are interested in that, you can reach out, and I say because it's who's in it, because we meet in the middle of the day.
Gotcha.
On Fridays, once a month. And then if you want to hire me or bring me to your school, tell your admin, like, hey, I want this lady to coach me so I can sit in the meeting and tell your director to let you do it.
I will have everything linked in the show notes so you can check out all of those great places. Najuma, I really want to thank you so much for joining me and for sharing your knowledge. And thank you for connecting with me.
Yay. Thank you for inviting me.
Yes, I love it.
Thank you everyone for listening.
Thank you for listening.
Thank you so much for tuning in to Conscious Pathways. I am perpetually astonished by the caliber of guests that I'm able to bring onto this podcast and share with you. Azuma just brought so much knowledge and just amazing forethought and story to this conversation. I hope that you learned just as much as I learned. I feel like every week that I record this podcast, every week that I edit it, I learn something new. I learn something new in the conversations, and I learn something new and different when I'm editing and going through the process of looking at the content. I know that for me, something I'm really going to take away from this conversation is how we can really engage in these hard conversations with our community, that it doesn't have to be just an individual going through this alone. While you can do it, it's going to be a lot harder if you don't have your school community behind you, if you don't have people that you can turn to and count on for guidance and support. So how important it is to find community when you're doing this work. It's still going to be hard work whether you're doing it on your own or you're doing it with others, but having someone there who can support you in this journey is so incredibly important. What I really took away from this is that anyone is able to do this work as long as you're willing to put in the work and try and learn and be open-minded. And I hope that's something that you're able to take away from this as well. Reach out on any of my social media platforms. I'm pretty much everywhere these days. Instagram, TikTok, the Conscious Pathways to Progress newsletter. Reach out. Even on my website, there's a space where you can put your thoughts as well. I want to hear your thoughts on this conversation. What did you learn? What information are you taking into your practices moving forward that will help you to really deepen your practice and really understand your students? What strategies are you taking into your practices, your daily work with young people in your lives? What are you taking and how are you implementing this in your life? I'm genuinely curious and I'd love to know. So reach out on any of our socials. I'll leave all of my socials down in the show notes. So please feel free to reach out there. On that note, again, I want to thank you so much for tuning into Conscious Pathways. Don't forget to like, share, and follow wherever you get your podcasts. Please leave a rating or review. It really does help the podcast to grow and find more listeners just like you. And wherever you are on your conscious journey, don't forget to lead with courage and kindness. And I'll see you next time for more transformative conversations in education. If you're like me, you believe in the power of education and social justice. And what's more powerful than a good book? Today, I want to share an incredible way for you to support local independent bookstores while you indulge in your love of reading. Have you ever heard of bookshop.org? They're an amazing platform that connects readers just like us to independent booksellers all around the world. Local bookstores are essential for our communities. They foster culture, curiosity, and a lifelong love of reading. But they need our support to thrive, especially in this age of e-commerce giants. Bookshop.org is committed to helping those bookstores flourish. Every purchase you make on their site financially supports independent bookstores. That's right, every single purchase. They provide these stores with the tools they need to compete online and maintain their vibrant presence in our neighborhoods. They put their mission and public good above financial interests, giving over 80% of their profit margin to independent bookstores. That's a commitment you don't see every day. In fact, in 2020, they were recognized as the best of the world by B Labs, ranking in the top 5% of all B corporations. And guess what? It's written into their government's documents that they will never sell the company to Amazon or any major retailer. That's dedication to their mission. Plus, as a climate-neutral company, they're committed to operating sustainably. Another reason to feel good about your purchases. So if you're looking to buy a book and make a positive impact, head over to bookshop.org and use my affiliate link that's linked in my show notes below. By doing so, you'll be supporting local bookshops and helping them thrive. Let's make a difference one book at a time. Happy reading, and thank you for supporting our local bookshops.